Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. Ron, wait, let's be honest here. You're not Ron Elving.
What? What are you talking about?
No. Okay, let me explain this. So Ron Elving is on vacation this week. He's demanding a recount in Northern California. He's trying to get some superdelegates. And so we decided we could have had almost anybody. Well, we couldn't have had, actually, we couldn't get anybody. And that's, we have Evie Stone sitting with us in the podcast. Evie Stone is the one who makes us very smart. Now, I mean, she's also under 70. Like, as you know, Ron Elving was at the League of Nations.
Barely.
Evie Stone is perhaps young. She's young.
You know, Ron covered the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
I know. But what's interesting is that it seems like every time we do a podcast, Evie says, well, here's what you should talk about. So I think we're going to have a very interesting... Actually, we also had a very interesting week, Evie Stone, Ron Elving, and that is the Barack Obama speech. I think from the beginning, I think it's fair to say that this guy tried to transcend race. He tried to hope that he was not the African-American candidate for president. He was Barack Obama, who happened to be black. But when you have comments by people like Geraldine Ferraro, who throw race to the forefront.
Or Bill Clinton mentioning Jesse Jackson's campaigns down in South Carolina.
But also Jeremiah Wright, who, not because of any campaign shenanigan by Hillary Clinton, but this has been Barack Obama's pastor for 20 years.
And you read reports that Oprah Winfrey was formerly a member of this church as well, and she sort of quietly disassociated herself from it. And Barack Obama, despite being a politician, despite, you know, all the baggage that goes along with that and running for president and knowing that people were going to be looking into his associations, he doesn't seem to have played his cards so wisely in terms of his associations with Tony Rezko and with his associations with Jeremiah Wright. You know, he can't have known that these weren't going to blow up somehow, but he has not been very speedy about putting those questions to rest.
Yeah, but it's almost hard to say that he waited too long. I think he got to a point where he had no choice. He was boxed into the corner. And certainly when you see the Jeremiah Wright sermons on YouTube or the evening news day in and day out, you have to make the case that he has to come forward and address this issue. The question was always whether, well, did he object to this in the past? Did he sit in the sermons and not object? So the issue of what Barack Obama does, how he either disassociates himself or addresses his relationship with Jeremiah Wright, his pastor for 20 years at Trinity Church, was, I think, the crux of what he had to say in that most, I thought, fascinating speech in Philadelphia.
I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother. A woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America. This country that I love.
Evie Stone, I guess the question is, now what? Is it about winning white ethnic votes? We saw in Mississippi, for example, Barack Obama winning 90% of the black vote, but Hillary Clinton getting 70 to 75% of the white vote. In states like that, it seems to be a racial division. Does a speech like this help Barack Obama with white ethnics, for example?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. The Obama campaign will tell you, well, look, you know, we did great among white voters in states like Iowa. We did great in Vermont. These are very predominantly white states.
Wyoming, Idaho, right?
Sure, but then there are states when that has not gone so well for them. And I think that the real question that is raised by this speech is, you know, that passage we just listened to, he basically equates what Jeremiah Wright was saying with the fact that all of us are associated with people who say things.
Like Ron Elving.
Well, anybody who's been to Thanksgiving dinner can tell you that, right. at any house in right. this country, that you know, you love your grandparents, you love your parents or whomever, and they speak and you think, I'm glad I didn't bring my date. The question is really whether, despite all he said in this speech about white resentment that's so true, whether people will hear that and think, oh, well, okay, now I understand where this anger that Reverend Wright speaks about may be coming from.
And I think only, I would make the case, or I guess a lot of people have made the case, that only a Barack Obama is somebody who could address this head on.
Oh, he certainly made that case.
Right, with one foot in the black community, one foot in the white community, which was really fascinating.
Oh, sure. Now, and, you know, as I've traveled the country with Don Gagne and David Green and NPR's other reporters as their producer, many voters that I talked to, and in particularly recently in Wisconsin and Ohio, we would say, well, so how do you think, how do you feel? You know, these are white Catholic voters or other white voters saying, how do you feel about the possibility of having this black candidate be so close to being the nominee for the Democratic Party? And over again, we heard people say, well, he's only half black.
I think that's true in the black community, too. There's some question about Barack Obama's blackness. Well, I think what ultimately is this has come down to is that no longer can Barack Obama avoid the fact that he is an African-American running for president. Perhaps this is to Hillary Clinton's advantage. She will make the case, and we'll talk about this later with superdelegates, but she made the case that his association with Jeremiah Wright, as eloquently as he defined it in this Philadelphia speech, may be too much for him to overcome white fears, white resentment with white voters in November.
It's true. And even Al Sharpton has been preaching to his own congregation or telling them, you know, well, I support Barack Obama, but I'm going to do it quietly because I don't want to hear pundits and right-wing people and Republican talk show hosts say, Sharpton did this, so what does that mean for Barack Obama? So he has made it clear that while a supporter of Obama, he's going to be doing it very quietly.
Now, you haven't been out on the road since this speech, so it's unfair to ask you what you might expect to hear, but do you think minds were changed in this whole thing?
I think it's a tough sell in Pennsylvania. You know, it's the speech, as powerful and as eloquent as it was, happened at 10:45 in the morning on a Tuesday. And although it has been very, very watched on YouTube, I think that the Jeremiah Wright excerpts are so soundbiteable and so powerful and in some ways horrifying to hear all the things that he says about HIV/AIDS being a purposeful attempt to eradicate African-Americans and so forth, that those things are so easy to get from 30 seconds. And one of the obstacles that Barack Obama has faced throughout his campaign is that the arc of his speeches is, you know, eloquent and lovely, but he's a little bit harder to excerpt in little bits. And I don't think that it's as easy to soundbite this speech. What the networks were taking away from it is what people get. And so it just depends on where you watch. I mean, some people say he refused on Fox News or on some other channels. The headline is Barack Obama would not disown Jeremiah Wright. And that's all you get.
Or he throws his grandmother under the bus.
Oh, right. Exactly. He accuses his grandmother of being a racist and says that makes it okay. Right. I mean, you don't hear all the rest of his speech and the nuanced things he has to say about the complicated state of race in America and the hostility and resentment that's built and is built on the foundation of slavery and Jim Crow.
I think it's fair to say that whatever this does to the Barack Obama candidacy, it brought up a conversation that, look, as he said during the speech, 50 years after the Brown decision, we still have segregated schools, we still have disparate income by race, we still have housing differences by race. So, I mean, the issues that he raised have certainly not gone away. And, you know, whether it's far more than Geraldine Ferraro and Jeremiah Wright. A lot of people have also equated the speech with JFK's speech to Protestant ministers in Houston in 1960, when obviously his Roman Catholic religion was the big issue of the day, and a lot of Protestant voters, a lot of voters were hesitant to vote for somebody who would become the first Catholic president in history. Now, ultimately, we can make the case that it was a successful speech because, after all, he was elected president that
year. But we don't know yet if it's a game changer.
Right, we don't. And so ultimately, we can't say historically what this means until we see if he wins the nomination. Now, obviously, there's somebody who's trying to make sure he's not the nominee, and that's Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that she had some momentum in her, on her side. I mean, even though the last contests, I guess, were Wyoming and Mississippi, both of which Barack Obama won. But the Clinton campaign is trying to make the case that they're winning the big states. They're getting the most votes in these big states. And all they need is a revote in Michigan and Florida, and they perhaps could even regain or at least have parity with Obama on the popular vote and delegate vote.
And of course, the Obama campaign is sort of trying to say everything they can possibly say to not have that happen without saying we don't care about the voices of the people in Michigan and Florida. And the Hillary Clinton campaign is doing everything they can to say Barack Obama is trying to stifle your vote.
Stifle democracy,
right. Of course, which is also a little bit ironic because Hillary Clinton in the past couple of days has really made this a civil rights, a voting rights issue. And she's talking about, you know, what people marched for and it was this right to vote. The irony there, obviously, is that she's also trying to support the right of the superdelegates to overturn whatever the people decide and forget about the popular vote and what everybody
wanted. Because where it stands right now, Barack Obama has the lead in both delegates and popular vote.
Exactly. So she's trying to have it both ways a little bit. But there are complicating matters beyond beyond just the simple, you know, should their votes be heard or not. Of course, I mean, there were a lot of Democrats and independents who voted in the Republican primary.
In Michigan,
because they knew that their votes wouldn't count, or they expected their votes not
to
count.
And Hillary Clinton was the only candidate on the ballot.
And furthermore, you know, there's some people are coming up with these numbers that maybe 2 million Democrats stayed home between the states of Michigan and Florida on those two election days and just didn't bother, because why go vote for somebody if it's not going to amount to anything? Why take that time out of your day and stand in line? And so the idea of counting those votes as they originally went seems not to be entirely fair. But then what do you do? Because if you let them re-vote and give them another opportunity, then all those people who voted in the Republican primary, for example, in Michigan, are not going to be able to vote again, despite the fact that they might want to. And you're also punishing these two states for breaking the rules by basically making them the most important states in the whole situation.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, it's kind of ironic. Here, they break the rules, knowing well that the DNC had sanctioned them for their delegates, saying if you move up to January, you lose your delegates. Okay, you could make the case that it was also Republican legislators in both states who also wanted to move up, but the Democrats didn't vote against it. Governor Granholm in Michigan did not vote against it. Democratic members of the state legislature in Florida did not vote against it. So the crock that you're blaming this all on Republicans, I don't think works. All they had to do was vote the dates they were supposed to vote in the beginning, and they could have been king or queen makers. But now to have them vote on June 3rd, when everything could be riding on this, I think now it rewards them basically for breaking the rules, or at least breaking party rules. Now, the question also is, as you say, the way it stands right now in Michigan, those Democrats who voted in the Republican primary, or independents voted in the Republican primary because there was no contest in the Democratic primary, they would be excluded from this new revote. And of course,
right, because they already voted in the primary this year.
Right, and the Obama people would never allow that to happen. So, and of course, you know, if you look at these states, while there may be perhaps a majority supporting Hillary Clinton in both states, and I suspect that if those primaries were held today, she very well could win both states. Speaking of Hillary Clinton, her papers that we've all breathlessly waited for, these are her papers when she from the National Archives when she was first lady, 11,000 pages.
They're just schedules, really.
Right.
Well, so Ken, what did we learn from I know you read all 17,000 pages yourself, so can you tell us what you got out of that?
I was shocked about the Vince Foster stuff.
Okay.
No. Okay. No, but I mean, a lot of people say, well, maybe there's something, some steamy stuff there that, you know, they'll show that she was really. But what I thought was the most interesting of all the excerpts I've read and the reports I've read is that at least on five occasions, if not more, she argued pretty strongly on behalf of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And in 1993 and 1994, she was pushing it in meetings after meetings with assorted folks. And of course, you know, she had said, and the Clinton administration said, this is one of the highlights, the grand moments of the Clinton administration. And as we saw in Ohio prior to that primary, where jobs are being lost overseas rapidly, that NAFTA was a terrible mistake and terrible for the economy. So that was kind of interesting.
Right. You've seen her come out and say, well, I was always lukewarm on NAFTA. But the other thing that seems notable or unnotable in these schedules is what we don't see. You know, we don't see any meetings that she has on these schedules. Now, these were just her public schedules and not her private schedules. And of course, a lot was redacted. But we don't see any meetings on FMLA, which the Family Medical Leave Act, which she has taken a lot of credit for helping get through. We see, I think, only one meeting on children's health insurance, which she has, in her campaign, has taken a lot of credit for. And we don't
Northern Ireland, Kosovo. Those.
Right. We don't see a lot of evidence for what exactly her role was in those things. You see a lot of foreign trips, and you see her having, you know, tea with Mrs. Yeltsin, but you don't see a lot of actual foreign policy hands in the dirt activity.
If we were doing a scorecard of the past week, how would you assess the last week, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? I mean, we haven't had a primary caucus for a while. We're not going to have anything until Pennsylvania on April 22nd. I got a phone call from a friend of mine who said, you must be enjoying this relaxation. But to me, I think it's more tense now than it's ever been. I think one reason, because I suspect that time is running out on this battle for the Democratic nomination.
Hillary Clinton, I guess you'd have to say, has come out on top because her polling numbers are improving. She's gaining ground. She's gotten back her lead in Pennsylvania that Barack Obama had eaten away at a little bit. You know, the most recent Gallup tracking poll has her ahead of Barack Obama nationally outside the margin of error.
Although, in fairness to national polls, that's including the 40 or so states that have already voted.
Which doesn't make any difference. Right. But that does help her argument as she's trying to help win over superdelegates. If she's going to try and get superdelegates to make the difference and to put her over the top at the convention, then she's going to need to really make a case that she has more momentum and that people, despite whatever they voted for back in, you know, January 3rd, that now the country really wants her. And that's what they're going to have to do. But in terms of the news cycle, she's definitely lost. I mean, this paper drop turned out to be a big nothing. And the week has belonged to the media drooling all over Barack Obama's speech that he made Tuesday morning.
And that's been a sensitive subject for the media and the campaigns throughout. And there's a fair argument to say that there's an Obama corner, an amen corner for Obama in the media. But I think this was a pretty remarkable speech. I mean, I remember, I've been covering politics a long time. I remember all the way back to Clinton. And I can't remember, by the way, let me just point out to Evie.
I was born without a sense of humor.
There was a President Bush before the current.
What?
But I think, though, that this was, whether you're an Obama fan, it has nothing to do with being an Obama fan, I think this was an amazing speech, given the fact that it's not the kind of issue people like to touch, the famous third rail. And also, especially Obama, who really did not want to be seen as the black candidate for president. I just thought it was a remarkable speech. I just didn't blink. I just listened to it, watched it, and I just thought, what an amazing speech. And then several hours later, maybe the next day, well, now what? What changes? I still think that Hillary Clinton wins on April 22nd in Pennsylvania. Now, of course, there are nine states or nine contests after Pennsylvania. But you just wonder what...
He's got a very tough road to hoe there.
Well, they both do.
He
in Pennsylvania and she for the nomination, which almost leads you into wondering who would ultimately be the stronger candidate against what's-his-name, who's...
Who?
Exactly. The Republican, the presumptive Republican nominee.
Oh, Fred Thompson?
Judge. Oh, you have been listening to the podcast. See, Ron Elving was always a big Fred Thompson. He's not here now, and he's not going to listen. But he was always wrong on this. I always told him.
That you told him it was going to be Rudy Giuliani.
Well, no, I didn't. I was a Sam Brownback guy. Okay, John McCain. So where is he this week? He's not making that much news, or is he?
Well, John McCain has celebrated the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War with a week-long swing to Iraq and Jordan and Israel. And also he's having a fundraiser in London, meeting with some Americans living abroad, trying to raise some money with them. He's with his buddies, Lindsey Graham, Senator from South Carolina. Republican Senator from South Carolina. And Joe Lieberman, the independent Democrat Senator from Connecticut, who is a McCain supporter. So who knows how many friends he has left in the Democratic caucus.
Who else was on that trip?
Ron Elving.
No, the reason why I'm very impressed with John McCain is that, unlike Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, I think John McCain has a complete understanding of what's at stake in the Mideast, and he really knows the players, and I think he has that gravitas that I think will pull him through in November.
Well, although there seems to have been a small fissure in the cliff of John McCain's foreign policy expertise when he accidentally confused the Sunnis and the Shiites in a press conference in Amman, Jordan.
Well, it's common knowledge and has been reported in the media that that Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and his good friend, independent Democrat Senator from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, whispered in his ear as at the end of the press conference that actually it wasn't so much Al-Qaeda that was being trained in Iran and going back into Iraq, but Shiite extremists, because Iran is a Shia country, and he came back and corrected himself.
I'm sorry, the Iranians are training extremists,
Senator McCain,
not Al-Qaeda.
So how big of a deal is this, Ken?
Perhaps, as some people point out, if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton had said something like that, there might have been a larger brouhaha, shall we say.
Well, and there was something of a brouhaha, and it was a welcome opportunity, I think, for Barack Obama to turn attention away from his own domestic kerfuffle and make himself an expert on a foreign policy issue, which is potentially where his weakness would lie in a general election campaign against John McCain.
Before we go, some other news. Thomas Reynolds, former chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, a Republican from upstate New York, announced this week that he is not going to seek re-election. Another, I think, like the 26, or it depends on if you're counting Dennis Hastert and people who are no longer there.
Right, resignations and deaths.
So between 26 and 30th, a Republican announced retirement, which is approaching an all-time record. And it doesn't look good for Republicans to pick up seats.
Well, do you think that his seat is at risk for turning over?
He barely won in 2006. It's a very competitive Democratic seat. Obviously, I don't know if the Elliott Spitzer matter affects Democratic chances. And who knows? That could be a one-week story. Or can continue. I know a lot of Republicans are demanding that Democrats return the tainted Elliott Spitzer money, which is what they did with Tom DeLay contributions. But it's interesting. Dennis Hester's seat is now held by a Democrat. Tom DeLay's seat is held by a Democrat. Democrats have legitimate shots, and other Republican leaders, Reynolds, perhaps Ray LaHood, perhaps John Doolittle in California.
And, Ken, I would note, too, that Tom Reynolds is not the only former chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee to be retiring from Congress this year. Tom Davis of Virginia also used to help get Republicans elected to Congress, and he's going away too.
That's a very good point, and another place where the Democrats could pick up a seat.
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I am Evie Stone.
And I am Ken Rudin.
Join Ron Elving and somebody else next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
This is where the party ends.